Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.
Hello and welcome. Come in and sit down and join us. The Pitch Talks podcast brought to you by North Star Bets. I am your boy, Andrew Zuber from The Parlay, joined, of course, as always, by my co-host from North Star Bets himself, Nick Ashburn. Nick, a very exciting stretch where it's September baseball. There is nothing better. The Blue Jays, obviously, sort of our focus is on Ontario, but baseball in general, coming down to the wire, it is the best time, in my opinion, to be a baseball fan. How are you enjoying the playoff push?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time, specifically for the Blue Jays, because they're coming off a stretch where they've won 6 of 7 games here. I don't want to say they've locked up a playoff spot. That would be a bit premature, but they haven't necessarily put the nail in the coffin of the Baltimore Orioles. But considering the quality of their roster, the quality of the Orioles roster, I think it's fair to expect that you go into this next stretch with the expectation being a playoff spot. And from this point, it's all seeding, which matters a great deal, as we're going to discuss later in the show, in terms of where you are within that wild card. And hell, you know, the Yankees are they're fading fast, so maybe there's a division race that could be going on in the AL East as well.
Yes, lots of Blue Jays talk to come. Our guest this week, Blake Murphy from Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590, host of Jays Talk Plus, which you can check out every single day. Going to get into some specifics, some drill down, that nice mix of analytics and the eye test that Blake is able to bring. And I think you and I are able to bring as well. I think give Blake all the credit.
Sell us short.
We can do it too. Yeah. Speaking of the analytics and the eye test, the story of the last 2 weeks, my goodness, Bo Bichette has woken up from, I don't want to say a slumber, but from being more or less league average, having some struggles, having some ugly at-bats, having some throwing issues, having whatever you don't like in Bo Bichette, you could see it. Whatever you do like, you could say, where is it going to be? He has turned it on and then some, completely owning the Pittsburgh Pirates and then completely taking over a doubleheader against the Orioles when they've needed him. He has shown up as a big game guy that has sort of been the pedigree for him. An aggressive dude, a guy who gets out there and takes his swings. You're not going to sneak much past him. Nick is a guy who is, you know, analytically inclined, somebody that is always looking a little bit deeper, always looking a little further. It's easy for me to be here and be like, well, he's swinging a lot, and that's always how he is. How are you feeling about Bo Bichette's turnaround? Is this something to, I don't want to say rely on, but is this like a staying power? Is this a fix? What do you feel?
I mean, it's not staying power in the sense that no one can be this good for an extended period of time. It's never happened in the history of baseball. That being said, you know, if you look at his season-long stats, it's kind of where he was last year now. He's kind of where he was in 2020, at least relative to the offensive environment. So what I think is interesting is just the way it's recontextualized his season. Like, he was having a down year. I think that's what we kind of all had in our heads. Like, oh, this isn't the best year for Bo. We weren't necessarily giving up on him or anything like that. But that was the way that we were thinking about. Now, you know, fast forward a week, and he's right where he was before. And there's a couple things that have shown up in this hot streak. You know, he's got these 5 home runs in 7 games. All of them have come on the first couple pitches of the at-bat. That's a really big thing with him, that aggressiveness. Another thing he's doing is he's really keeping the ball off the ground. And we talk about that a lot with Vladdy. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But it's important with Bo, too. Like, at the beginning of this year in April, he was pounding the ball into the ground. And that's one of the reasons he got off to such a brutal start. And he has that healthy launch angle right now. He's spraying the ball in the air to all fields. Like, I don't know. Does this mean he's going to be the Blue Jays' best player down the stretch? Who's to say? Like, you know, he didn't have a great game on Wednesday. That could be the beginning of a cold stretch for all we know. But, you know, his season has been reshaped a little bit, and he's showing a lot of the stuff that makes him impressive. You know, the last 7 games was the best 7-game stretch of his entire career, so it's pretty hard to ignore that.
Yeah, birds fly, fish swim. Bo Bichette is aggressive early in the count. That is sort of that is who he is. You don't really want to change it depending on some short-term stuff, but it certainly has been something that had looked like a problem that it now looks like something you can deal with. Something else that looks like a problem with this team, and it has basically all year, more or less, the fifth starter role. Mitch White has not been it. He has been sent down. The sort of question mark there at the back. This is something that obviously, as we approach the playoffs, they're not going to have a fifth starter in the playoffs, but there is a month to go. Nothing is locked up. There is seeding to fight for. What is your gut feeling? What do you think they should be doing with this fifth starter thing? Should it be a bulk? Are we getting the Kikuchi Express? Are we getting Richards can come out and start it? Then we get to hand it over to Kikuchi. Are you giving Mitch White another look 5 days from now? What is sort of your gut instinct on how to best approach the problem at the back of the rotation?
I think it is going to be a bulk thing. I don't think it's going to be one individual guy who does it. You know, Kikuchi has shown himself to be unreliable. I think longer term, there's reason for hope with him. Same with Mitch White. Like, I think there's some interesting things about Mitch White as a pitcher. Like, he's kind of like a Ross Stripling who throws a little bit harder in a lot of ways, which is an interesting package. But right now, it's simply not working. What you have at the moment is you've got the expanded roster, right? So you can have that bigger bullpen that you can go to, and that lets you do the Richards and Kikuchi. I don't know if that's going to be a strict piggyback that they stick to. People talk about piggybacks all the time, especially in the minors, and it's rare to see one that's sort of carved out and defined at the major league level. But you have 9 relievers to play with. I think they have some other guys in the rotation they feel good about going deep into games. Manoah's on that list. You know, Berríos, for all his struggles, he consistently gets relatively deep into games. Gausman can do that too. So in theory, the top of the rotation will rest up this bullpen, and I think the bullpen will eat up those fifth days because they have been a disaster for this team all season long. Like, whether it's Kikuchi, sure, or White, whoever has been the quote-unquote fifth starter, the team's record in those games is horrendous. And fifth starters aren't supposed to be good. Like, very few teams have five good starters. It's just, it's a rarity. It's a hard commodity to find. And the understanding is that guy's not going to be necessarily average even, but the Blue Jays have been so far below average that it's really hampered them all year long.
One of the other subplots of the last little bit, and it's, listen, they have a ton of games against the Baltimore Orioles coming up. They've played the Orioles a ton. They are fending off the Orioles at the back of the playoff race. And the Orioles, listen, the Jays calling card has been where they're exciting young team full of hot prospects. All of a sudden, here are the Orioles, which, if you look at recent history, Orioles may be the Jays, in playoff history, a team that they've had a little bit of a rivalry with. We're seeing benches clear. We're seeing long stares. We're seeing Alek Manoah staring down an entire team before his start. We're seeing Brian Baker getting into the news with talking some smack. Is this in the future going forward, put your prognosticating hat on, are the Orioles or the Rays a bigger threat to be the Blue Jays rivals coming forward? We're going to let New York and Boston have their own. I don't know if you've heard New York and Boston are rivals, but are you looking at the Orioles or the Rays as the Jays top rival coming forward? Some young teams in division.
Yeah, since the Blue Jays have been in the AL East as it's configured right now, like you said, you know, Boston and New York have each other, and so that's not really going to change for the foreseeable future. That means that the Blue Jays don't really have a natural rival. I thought it was going to be the Rays when we had the Charlie Montoyo, Kevin Cash thing, like the Jedi Master and the Padawan, except with reversed ages type of situation. I thought that would sort of help spur that a little bit. That's fallen off, obviously, with Montoyo exiting. And the Rays are hard to trust being really good over the long term because there's a little bit of smoke and mirrors to what they do. And as soon as they run out of advantages in terms of player evaluation, it's easy to see them falling off the path of being competitive. I don't know if that's going to happen in 2 or 3 years, but we're prognosticating pretty far into the future here. The Orioles have a hell of a foundation to build off of. And I could see them hanging around and having real staying power, which is a problem for the Blue Jays. And, you know, there's a little friction already. I could definitely see Baltimore being the big rival, I don't know, 5-6 years out.
I want to think about anything in the world other than playing games in the Trop. I just hate, I'd rather watch, if they're going to be rivals, I'd rather them be rivals in Camden Yards than in Tropicana Field. That is like easy call for me to make. But speaking of games in Tropicana Field, speaking of games in Camden Yards, speaking of games on the road, pondering that I've been pondering lately, the Blue Jays continue to be at the bottom of this wild card chase. The extra wild card spot is coming in handy for them. They've been hovering around the third or second spot. The way things shake out, you know, they're going to be on the road more than likely if they're in one of those bottom ones. Obviously, there's a ton of games left. They could move up. But my question to you, Nick, is it looks like all three wild card teams are going to have better records than the Central team. So that'll be... The team in the Central is going to play the lowest wild card team. My question to you is, would you rather, not a classic, would you rather, but is it to you, is it preferable to be the third wild card team and be on the road in, say, Cleveland or Minnesota, depending, or would you rather be the second wild card team and be on the road in likely Tampa Bay, maybe New York, which do you think is better? Is it crazy to think maybe you would rather be the third wild card team than the second one?
No, I don't think it's crazy at all. You know, going to Tampa, going to Seattle, I think Seattle's a relatively scary team. They've been fantastic over the last sort of month and a half. Tampa, you know, we talked about how the Trop is just an unpleasant place for the Blue Jays. It has been for a long time. I don't think there's a mythos to that that's necessarily going to drive game results, but watching the games there is unpleasant. The Rays are really tough in short games because of the way short series, because of how they can play their matchups and use their bullpen. I think you absolutely want to go face an AL Central team. Now, the first wildcard spot is not out of the Blue Jays' reach by any means. I think that's what you really want. You want to host the games. But if you're going to go on the road, you know, Cleveland is a pesky team. They've got a lineup full of guys that don't strike out. But they also don't have a ton of thump. Like, if you get a big day from your offense, you feel pretty good that you can put one away against Cleveland. Their rotation is sort of all right, as opposed to being fantastic as it has been when they were real contenders around 2016 or so. You know, Minnesota could theoretically come back, but they're very injured right now. Like, that team is kind of in shambles. I'd be very surprised if they make it. So I'd absolutely want to be the third wild card. Now, how you go about that is a little bit weird. In baseball, it's tough to throw a game. Like, the way the game is structured, you know, even a AAA roster could beat the Los Angeles Dodgers in any given night, just because you never know who's going to come through and perform in a tiny sample. And you also don't want to get caught being a team that's clearly trying to throw a game. So I'd be very interested to see how that's handled. My guess is that they just kind of plow straight forward, even if the best possible outcome, if you're actually drawing it up at home, would to be in that third wild card.
Yes, I think I agree with you. Obviously, being at home is the preference for sure. Not playing in Tropicana Field, I think that about just about anything. Gonna slide into a new segment here. We have we're gonna throw in, I think it's called Good Take, Bad Take. We're gonna present one take each, a well thought out thing that we are able to sort of believe in and argue for, and then a bad take, which is almost zero thought, just a gut throw. Do you want to go first or second, Nick?
I'll lead it off. Yeah, I mean, I think when I think of us as a pair, I think that this is a dichotomy that we're able to attack very effectively. You know, the well thought out thing and the complete nonsense. Let's start with a thought out take that I have, which is that people have kind of written off the San Diego Padres since Fernando Tatis Jr. got the suspension and it's clear he's not going to return to the team. People were fantasizing about that team when Soto was added, like, wow, you add Soto to Machado to Tatis Jr. and you've got Josh Bell too. This team is going to be incredible. This team is dangerous. I think they're still dangerous, you know, like, especially adding those two players to the middle of the lineup. I think they're better after the deadline than they would have been if they had gotten Tatis back but not made that deal. And at the beginning of the year, if I said to you, are the Padres a dangerous team based on their starting pitching, based on the stars they have in their lineup? I'm a big Jake Cronenworth guy also. I think that he's like a quasi-star that doesn't get a lot of attention. And another thing is that they've got a direct replacement in Kim. Like, Kim has been fantastic for them at shortstop, a near 3-win player. You go through this rotation, you've got guys like Darvish, Clevinger coming back. Blake Snell is like the fifth starter for this team right now. Musgrove has been a fringe Cy Young candidate. I know they have that tough road through the wild card. They're not going to catch the Los Angeles Dodgers. But this is a team that I think the moment Tatis Jr. got the suspension, everybody stopped talking about them, and I think that's a little bit unfair.
Nick, that is a good take. It's always tough. You sort of, the stars are what brings the eyeballs, and you have to remember baseball is such a different animal. It's not like you're losing Giannis from the Bucks. You're losing a piece, one of 26. So I think that is a well argued and well put together. My good take, Nick, with absolute grain of salt, how good this tape may be. I love the extra wild card spot. I am old enough to remember just one team from the East and one team from the West. I'm old enough to remember three divisions and one wild card team. Obviously not that old to remember two wild card teams. I was initially pretty against the extra wild card. I was sort of like, you're making it, one of the beauties of baseball is that it really means something when you make the playoffs. It's like, it's supposed to be hard. It's not supposed to be like the NBA or the NHL where half the league makes the playoffs. I have to admit, coming down here to stretch, it's been really entertaining and really good for the game. I think you look at a team like Seattle that in a different era maybe doesn't load up, maybe thinks last year wasn't quite it, and looks like, oh, we're 10 back of the Astros. We're never going to win the division. Let's continue kicking the can down the road. I think it is spurred on some teams to really believe in themselves and make a push. And also for me, it makes me recontextualize teams in the past. You look at the late aughts Blue Jays, 2008 Blue Jays. It's like, not only would that have been a competitive team, maybe they approached the deadline differently. Maybe they would have been a different, you know, they would have made some moves to push in. 2014, 2010, there's a bunch of different years where you look back and you go, man, an 86, 80, 87 win team, we used to go, oh, mediocre. And now you're looking, that's a good team. Like a 90 win team is a good team and deserves to have a shot. I know there is the worry that like one day we get a below 500 NL Central team in the playoffs and they win the whole thing, yada, yada. It's going to be the Cardinals, by the way, if that ever does happen. But I think it's been good for baseball. I am happy to be wrong about the extra wild card spot.
I like that take. I also like the call out of the 2008 Blue Jays. That rotation that team had with Halliday and Burnett, and then you had Markham and McGowan and Jesse Litch, was literally the best rotation in baseball that season. It's kind of unfortunate how the career trajectory of some of those guys ended up going. But yeah, it's the type of team that was a good team. And yeah, in a different era, they may have, you know, they may have had a shot. And with that rotation, maybe they would have made some noise. The other thing I like about this is the three-game wildcard series. Like the one-game wildcard game, it is so dramatic. And I understand from a viewer perspective, it is a great thing to tune into. But, you know, baseball really doesn't show itself in short stints. So giving those teams a little bit more of a chance is something that I'm also in favor of. Here is a take that is based on maybe the absence of logic. It's a little bit of punching down right now because of what's happened to the Mets recently. My take is that the Mets are cursed, and you can't convince me they're going to win a World Series in the foreseeable future. So much money spent on this team, so much talent, so much of them being theoretically unstoppable, but I think Steve Cohen is like the classic clueless rich guy. I think that results in dumb moves. I think that Buck Showalter is a wild choice to be a manager of a team that's supposed to win the World Series in 2022. I know Blue Jays fans in particular had sort of front row seat to some of his stuff, but in general, it just like, you know, we've seen what happened with Tony La Russa with the Chicago White Sox. Like the game passes you by. I think the game passed him by a little bit. And the whole Jacob DeGrom of it all, like, you know, on a per inning basis, truly incredible, like an absolute force of nature, never going to be healthy over the long term, throwing the way he does. Scherzer is super old. I don't know. It's funny. You can look at this team on paper and be like, they're as good as those other teams. Like they're as good as the Yankees when the Yankees were rolling. They're as good as, you know, the Astros, the Dodgers are maybe a half step above everyone else. But I just don't think that in the near future, even with like the Lindor and the Pete Alonso of it all, the deep lineup, I just don't think it's ever going to happen. I think that the Mets are going to be the Cubs type franchise for the foreseeable future.
The danger of a funny small thing being beat into the ground with the closer intro, where it's like, oh, cool closer intro. It's like, oh, they did black and white. Oh, they're bringing out the guy who plays the trumpet and... It's like, okay, we get it. It's a cool intro. It's like you've beaten into the ground over the course of a month, and now I don't want to see it anymore, and now it's cursed. I'm with you, Nick. My bad take, and maybe this will get me shouted at online, I do not want robot umpires. I think it's terrible. I think it's a terrible idea. I think my evidence of this is replay in every single sport. We did this. So we said, oh, we got to have replay, and now it's like, I hate it. I hate it. I hate the guy slides into second and he pops off the bag for a split second. And I hate all of this stuff. I get the impetus is like the umpire scorecard comes out and we get this umpire missed the 6 inches off the plate. He missed it every single time. It's not supposed to. Who gave you these? Here's the thing. Whoever told you this stuff was supposed to be fair? That's not how it. Life isn't fair. It's not supposed to be that way. It's not how it's supposed to work. This idea that and the idea that robot umpires is going to be bliss and perfect and work. People are going to find a way to game this. The Rays are going to find a way to game this system to cheat, to not cheat it, but like to find the edge and get BS strikes or things that don't look like strikes turn into strikes or. I like catcher framing. I like all this stuff. I like the little micro parts of the game. And I think if we strip all that out, I think we're going to hate robot umpires pretty quick. I just like, as much as I just said, like I was pretty against the extra wild card. I'm so fervently against the robot umps. I cannot have this argument another time. Am I crazy?
I think that a lot of what you say is true, especially in the near term. I think that in the early robot ump era, we're going to see a lot of friction, a lot of weirdness, a lot of, you know, the rays of the world game the system. I think much like a lot of things, things will settle in. And, you know, 10 years into it, it's going to be fine and everyone will have figured it out. Generally speaking, yeah, I'm for accuracy and justice, for lack of a better term. So I would be pro robot ump. I understand what you're talking about, though. The framing is, it's interesting because that is a big component of catcher value. The most valuable defensive position is going to lose a big part. And it'll be interesting to see if we see more kind of Ryan Dumit, big hitting catchers who don't really know how to catch the ball in the future in the robot ump world. A lot of things are going to change. I understand you being resistant to that change. Change can be scary, but I will have to say that I'm still in team robo ump.
Fair. Jump into the mailbag quickly. We have some fun questions in the mailbag. The first one comes from Noise for Winfield. Are the Yankees actually just this bad? Nick, but just that simple.
I mean, the simple answer is no. Are the Yankees actually bad? No, because, you know, they've been really bad for not an insignificant amount of time. I think at the beginning of the season, they weren't as good as they appeared because that was a historic win pace and they weren't a historically talented team. But they are a very talented team. They've got a good rotation. I think getting rid of Jordan Montgomery was a big mistake, a bit of an unforced error there. Aaron Judge is doing his thing. When this lineup is healthy, it can be pretty impressive. There's a lot of, you know, they're fairly old in the position player core, so there's worried of creakiness late in the season, guys getting run down. I could see them being this team that doesn't live up to its regular season pedigree in the playoffs. Like, I'm not picking them to win the World Series, for instance, but I don't think that means they are, quote-unquote, this bad.
I think they're pretty close to this bad. The Kiner Falefa is not a good offensive player. Josh Donaldson is well past his expiry date. Aaron Judge obviously has been unbelievable carrying this offense single-handedly, but they're giving a ton of at-bats to Hicks. They're giving a ton of at-bats to Torres. They're giving a ton of at-bats to a bit of a creaky Anthony Rizzo. The Montgomery thing was a misstep. I don't think they're this bad, but I do not think they are the team. Like, I don't think they're even a 100-win team. The pace that they've been on, they were like 122 pace. So obviously not that, but I think they're back to earth, and I have a sneaky pick later on in the show that we'll get to when we get to the run line after our guest. I got two more for you, Nick. Just two quick, easy ones. Who can eat more wings in a single sitting, me or you? That comes from Jeff Simmons, our old pal.
Yeah, we'll call him a friend of the show. I mean, we haven't discussed this before recording, so we're going to like just bring out claims here and see who's on top. Sure. I can eat a lot of wings. I'll put it this way. Like, I feel pretty confident. Eating wings is a young man's game. There's no doubt that my 100%. Ability to eat wings has declined over time. The aging curve on eating wings is probably dissimilar to baseball. I think you're probably peaking around 1920, something like that, maybe even a little bit earlier. So I'd say I'm deep into my decline phase, but like many Hall of Fame type players, even deep into your decline phase, you can be pretty effective. So I've visited St. Louis All You Can Eat Wings a few months ago. I think it was 3.5 pounds I put away, and that might not have been the theoretical limit.
Yeah. Push that sun up and give us one more day of summer. I will say as well, a huge wing fan. I agree with you. I think I am past my peak of wing eating or eating in general, eating for sport even. Three pounds in my last, like, I'm going to go ahead and eat as many as I can. 3 pounds was like, oof, I'm uncomfortable, but I can do this. If you're telling me that you recently did 3.5 pounds, I feel like I could get to that, but probably not push past it. And you probably have the championship rounds in you. So I'm going to give you a narrow edge only because my days are behind me. And the appeal of eating to the point of discomfort has been gone from my life. Whereas that used to be like a badge of honor. That's now like, I don't think I want my next day to be a fucking disaster.
Aftermath, really. Like, it's not even about being uncomfortable in the moment. I don't think that has necessarily changed that much over time. It is really about how much am I willing to make the next day of my life a complete write-off. And, you know, as you get older, you have fewer days left on this earth, and you don't want to spend them in the aftermath of a horrible wing feast. So, yeah, that's my advice to listeners is you don't have to do it. You don't have
and you
to
get
eat
less
as many
days.
Wings as you can.
You get less days, I think, if you eat 4 pounds of wings. And finally, true. Our old friend, the doctor, Internet, who went to Internet med school. So this is an educated question. Very simple, Nick. Is it better to sit or stand?
That's a big question in a general sense. I believe the question was asked as to the nature of this particular show. I would say it's better to sit. I am sitting now. There's a lot of health risks associated with sitting for a long time. I was never able to make the conversion to being a standing desk guy, but I have heard that that's a big move and it's advisable. So I'd say it is better to stand in life, but it is better to sit in podcasting.
Sitting is the new smoking, Nick. Sitting is the new smoking.
Yeah, the next generation, no one will do it. Like the one after Gen Z, I don't know what that's called. Like they'll just be standing the whole time.
I think Gen Z thinks smoking is cool again. I think I read that somewhere. Smoking is on the way back.
But drinking's out, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, we're incredibly well qualified to discuss these trends.
By the way, we are not advocating smoking on this podcast. Speaking of smoking, we got a smoking hot guest coming up. We're going to welcome to the show from Jay's Talk Plus on Sportsnet Radio 590 The Fan. Every single day you can catch him, and you can always find him online, giving great insights during the games, before and after the games, and taking calls and messages from the fan base. Very in touch. The great Blake Murphy joins us now. Joining us now on the Pitch Talks podcast, we are so thrilled to welcome the host of Jay's Talk Plus. You can catch every single day on Sportsnet Radio 590 The Fan. 3 to 5. I've heard rumors that maybe we're getting some extended as we get into the playoffs. Well, I'll let you handle that, Blake, but a guy who's in there every single day in the trenches, talking to the Blue Jays fans, coming up with topics with great guests, has really, really, really dug into the season and been a huge add to the Blue Jays coverage this year. You probably knew him before as the best Raptors reporter going. He has switched lanes, become one of the best Blue Jays reporters going. It is an absolute pleasure to welcome to the show my good friend, Mr. Blake Murphy. Blake, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, man. That was a wonderful introduction with a lot of half-truths. I appreciate it, though. I appreciate it. It's been a little bit of a weird transition, not just switching sports, but like you use the term reporter. And I very much felt like I was a reporter around the Raptors and like reporter slash analyst, I guess. But this, I'm not reporting anything. Like I just sit in a radio booth and my show happens to be the exact times that the clubhouse is open. So I can say whatever I want. I don't have to show my face. I don't have to go around anyone. I've only met I think Mitch White is the only guy on the current team I've actually met. It's great. I just shooting from an ivory tower here.
Sports entertainer. How about that? Yeah. Blue Jays sports entertainer. The topic of du jour, if you will, we saw Alek Manoah really shoving yesterday on Wednesday. That has been a continued theme throughout the course of this year. He's getting capital G, that guy treatment. He is that dude. He is the ace. Been coming on quick as somebody who has really, you've been there diving into the stats and the numbers, a mix of obviously analysis and eye test. What have you seen the Alek Manoah growth that sort of beginning from where he was last year, obviously a nice jump onto the scene to like now we are in September of his second season and he is the dude for this team.
So obviously last year he has this tremendous rookie season. There's no way to cut it up that wasn't super encouraging. If you wanted to get a little more granular, one of the things I found most encouraging, especially down the stretch, was he showed what I think is the sign of a top-end rotation guy, and it's, can you give me something on a day you don't have your best stuff? And with, I think there were two exceptions last year, maybe three, he was always giving you 5, sometimes even 6, even if he didn't have it. And he looked a little fatigued down the stretch last year. There was a game against the Yankees in September that stood out where I think he gave up 3 over 6. I might be off by a third of an inning or something like that. And it was clear he didn't have it, but he still got you through 6 in a very important divisional game. And I look at this year, there was that trend statistically of, okay, well, his swing and miss stuff has gone down month over month. His ERA has gone down month over month. And even in that lull, there was a 4-start stretch from the end of July to the middle of August where he wasn't great in any of those games, but he still gave you 5+, sometimes even 6. And I think that's such a valuable thing to have at the top of your rotation, especially given the challenges the Jays have had at the back end of the rotation and the toll that's had on the bullpen. And then, you know, you want to talk about statistics you can dive into. You look at these last 4 starts, those trends are gone. His velocity was back up above his average in last night's start. He has struck out 5 or more batters and I think 7 straight starts. He's back to missing more bats. And there's just like Kevin Gausman has had a better season if we're looking at strikeouts, walks, and home runs. The three true outcomes, the three things a pitcher can really control. Alek Manoah has, it's felt like he's had zero disappointing starts or zero times where he goes out there and doesn't give you everything, even when he doesn't have his best stuff. And that, to me, obviously you want the guy with the killer ERA, the killer strikeout to walk ratio. You know, if you're looking Gausman, Manoah, and you don't have to split them apart, but you know, Gausman has all the projection metrics that are even stronger. A top of the rotation guy to me is a guy that every 5 days you're getting something from, whether it's his absolute best stuff and he's dominant like he's been his last three starts, or whether he doesn't have it and he still finds a way to give you 5 2/3, 6 innings to save the bullpen and keep you competitive in a game when he's not at his best. And Alek Manoah has kind of gone through all of that this year, starting out dominant, going through the fatigue stretch, but still giving you something. And now right back to that guy we saw early in the year. And honestly, like, probably with the injuries in the AL on the periphery of the Cy Young conversation now.
And he's the one who's going to stare down the Orioles after the game.
Yeah, he wishes you would. That was a very long answer, and I'm sorry for that, but it comes down to he wishes you would.
Blake, Zub's reference to your basketball background in his lovely intro, and it's not to say that you haven't been involved with baseball before. I know you've written about baseball in the past, but having spent so many years sort of focusing on the NBA, where some people would say you see literally the best athletes in the world and, you know, everyone who's any good, apart from a couple of guards, are kind of over 6'7". With all of that in mind, how does the Alejandro Kirk experience, watching someone who's 5'8", has weighed as much as sort of 265 pounds in the past, how does that strike your eye as someone who's kind of been focused on the NBA for the last little bit?
Yeah, it's funny. So, like, we see Tyler Wells yesterday, and he's, what, like 6'8", 255 or something like that. And that's, like, the biggest guy you get in baseball, him and Manoah. And I'm looking, I'm like, oh, yeah. I even tweeted a joke. Like, yeah, he's an undersized power forward in the G League who just, like, throws his ass around and gets a lot of rebounds. So it's a pretty big adjustment. You know, there's a one of the better lessons from the last few years of the Raptors has been to not – kind of judge a book by its cover or not judge a guy by what he can do right now. And obviously Fred VanVleet's the Raptors example. He doesn't have the same dimensions as Kirk, but he was a guy who came in, he's too small. He's too short. He's not athletic enough. He's not going to be able to do it. But you have to look past that sometimes, especially when guys have really special outlier skills. In Fred VanVleet's case, his basketball IQ and his three-point range. In Alejandro Kirk's case, the ability to manage the strike zone as a hitter and the bat to ball capability. And now we're seeing the pitch framing too. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. He's a guy that obviously your eyes are drawn to pretty quickly for a lot of reasons. But it's also a good, I think, player identification and development lesson or reminder, at least, that yeah, we look for certain things because certain body types or certain skill sets or a way a baseball or basketball player looks, because that's a helpful way to filter this huge, huge, huge pool of potential players down to a manageable pool. But you don't want to write guys off just because of that, especially once they show you a few outlier things beyond, you know, their limitations.
Speaking of maybe outliers, maybe not outliers, but you have, taking calls on your show, taking texts, you have a great sort of handle on the pulse of the team and the fan base. Somebody that I think has gone from, you know, absolute upper tier to maybe slipped off a little bit to now back the explosion that has happened the last little bit. Bo Bichette, sort of a, I don't want to say controversial, but somebody that you easy to find opinions on, especially earlier this year when things maybe weren't clicking as well. All of a sudden, he's back. He's smashing home runs. He's completely carrying both ends of a doubleheader. You're somebody that, you know, I've listened to a ton of the show and your analysis of sort of when he's playing well or playing poorly, the outlier stuff, the underlying things, maybe relatively staying the same. What are you seeing? Is there anything you're seeing that it gives you cause for optimism that maybe he has turned a corner, or is the aggressiveness just sort of lining up with the right pitches early in counts? What do you sort of think about his turnaround in the last little bit?
No, I think it's, you know, there's really good process underlying it, and that's what you are most encouraged by. Like, yeah, you have a 200 WRC plus over the last, I don't know, since August 17th, when this kind of hot streak started for the team. Like, yeah, you're double an average hitter. You're double the hitter you were before that. obviously the results speak for themselves when you're at that level for, you know, a 21 game stretch. But underneath that, and I actually thought he started showing some signs of coming out of the slump he'd been in even before the results started coming. And that's, you know, it can be a tough thing to diagnose with Bo Bichette, because you never want, like, no matter what he's doing at the plate, you would never want to go to Bo Bichette and be like, hey, Bo, we want you to be not an aggressive hitter. Like, Bo Bichette being so aggressive so early in counts is what makes him Bo Bichette. It's also what makes him very uncomfortable for opposing pitchers to pitch against, because you kind of have to change how you're approaching sequencing and how you're attacking him. Because if you make a mistake early, you don't get the benefit of that's a guy. Like, you could make a mistake early to Kevin Biggio because he doesn't really want to swing the bat until he has two strikes. He'd rather take a walk and keep the lineup moving. You do that same approach to Bo Bichette, you're getting hammered. So he makes pitchers uncomfortable with that aggression. What I've seen the last little bit, and this again started a little before the hot streak came, is that being more selectively aggressive, and that's a hard thing to quantify. Like, we can look at the heat maps and stuff like that. Basically, it comes down to, for lack of a better term, good takes. Are you, even if they're strikes, are you laying off pitches because you think you can get a better one to do damage on later in the count? And I thought that there was, in one of the doubleheader games, and I mentioned this on the show, and it seems silly, right? He has 10 hits over 2 days and 4 home runs. And I'm like, oh yeah, but his strikeout was the most impressive. And it wasn't. Obviously, all those home runs, like, you had a home run to all three fields. That says a lot about your swing mechanics, how well you can use the entire field, your bat to ball skill, all that stuff. But there's a strikeout where he took two borderline pitches for strikes. They were both good takes. He gets down 0-2, but it's not the typical Bo Bichette down 0-2, fouling off one out of the zone, and then, you know, having to chase at something 0-1. It was two good takes. And then he got that count back to 3-2. He fought his way back into it. And then, yeah, he eventually struck out on a slider, swing and miss. But that's a quality plate appearance. That's the type of plate appearance that makes a pitcher work for it. And I don't know that I feel the same if those first two strikes are swinging strikes at those same kind of things. So we can look at chase rate. And his chase rate's down a little bit during this hot streak. But you still want him swinging at stuff out of the zone sometimes because he can do damage on it. He's a very good, you know, you look at just a little bit up out of the zone. He's fine with that. You're more than fine with him swinging at those. It's more that, you know, that mentality of leaving something you can hit, because again, he has elite swing mechanics, elite swing stuff, good bat to ball skill. Obviously among the league leaders in hits 2 years in a row now, that's there, but the discipline and the knowledge of your own strengths and what a pitcher's trying to do to you to lay off something you can hit for something you can drive is really difficult. But it's something I thought the last month or so he's unlocked something in terms of that decision making.
The impressive strikeout is from my favorite branch of sports analysis, when Derrick Henry runs for 220 yards and the analysis goes, yeah, but the pass blocking is what's really impressive.
Yeah. Well, what about, you want me to come on? It's like, hey, how's Bo Bichette? I'm like, hey, I love all those home runs. He hit a whole bunch of home runs the other day. That's cool. And it is, obviously, again, like, you 100%. Hit a home run to all three fields. Like, show me the guys in the league that can do that in general over the course of a whole season. It's a short-ish list. So to do that all in one game, but yeah, I think that's the strikeout's an easier way to be like, yeah, he's waiting on his stuff. And you know, when I used to have friends when I coached that were like, another one of the coaches was always like, shoebox. Like, you don't, the strike zone is this big, but you want your zone that you're trying to attack to be the size of a shoebox. And that's what you're looking for. But obviously that is like another level of plate discipline and pitch recognition.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I remember he had an at-bat in Pittsburgh on Saturday, and I remember thinking, that's his best at-bat of the year, and I think the end result was like a single, because it is easy to be like, oh yeah, 420 feet is nothing, but like, I love to see him foul off, you know, six pitches and take the right balls and work his way back from 0-2. The guy the other side of the coin for that for Blue Jays fans right now has got to be Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and I mean, maybe this one is more of a simple one because the ground ball issues have cropped back up. What are you seeing with him in the last month or so, where he really has been a below average hitter? You know, we know that the offensive environment is down overall, and so his last year wasn't really achievable in a sense. But what are you seeing from him in this recent slump?
Yeah, the ground ball stuff is pretty maddening. at this point. And, you know, for the month of August, he was up around 57% ground ball rate. He's at 50% to start the year here. And yeah, he's had ground ball issues a little bit in the past. There was that, you know, there was a stretch at the start of the lot of the pandemic shortened season where everything was on the ground. And we kind of went through this same conversation, but that short chunk of July that year is the only time he's ever gone any amount of time with ground ball rate this high. And you isolate for situations with runners in scoring position or high leverage plate appearances, and that gets astronomical, the degree to which he's putting the ball on the ground. If you look at just his August and September ground ball rate with runners in scoring position, it was 75% in August, and it's at 83% so far. And that's a tiny sample, but he's come up 8 times in September with men in scoring position, and he's hit 7 ground balls. Like, Bruce, that's
brutal.
Yeah, that is not fun. It's not fun to watch. It's like, if you could in-game bet right now on North Star, like, hey, this next thing is going to be a ground ball, you'd be rich anytime runners in scoring position. And you know, I don't claim to know the swing mechanics stuff and the foot positioning as well as, say, a Joe Siddle, who did that excellent breakdown at sportsnet.ca and on Blue Jay Central about the positioning of Lat's bat head or his back elbow or even, you know, where his feet are coming down on his stride. And that stuff was super interesting to me. That's not something that I can pick up in real time, really, the same way maybe I could for something in basketball. But it's nice to see that someone as smart as Joe Siddle is also seeing the mechanical stuff that is a drain on Vlad right now, because you can get into some of the pitch selection stuff, some of the how are pitchers attacking him, but honestly, he's been shaky enough and predictable enough in these spots that I don't know that pitchers are even, like, obviously you're still worried about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in a big spot at the plate, but we're very far removed from the, like, oh, every big Vlad plate appearance is an automatic walk because you're going to pitch around him and he's got good management of the strike zone. He's out of sorts there. And I don't really have a great explanation for it. The results are what they are. He's hitting the ball on the ground way, way, way too much. But how to fix that is over my head a little bit right now.
Yeah. One of those things about supernatural talent is I just sort of keep assuming, like, eventually he's just going to fix it, and then it'll be fixed, and that'll be sort of the way that the story goes. That's the hope. Speaking of the hope, and speaking of sort of, you know, I mentioned earlier your finger on the pulse of the fan base, and you also spent years covering the Raptors. Toronto fans in general, very passionate crew. Having spoken and received texts and phone calls from Blue Jays fans every single day this season, and having done years of mailbags and comment sections and Twitter mentions about the Raptors, how do you compare those two fan bases, maybe in terms of I don't say panic, but in terms of patience, in terms of process, in terms of passion? Where are the strengths and the weaknesses, the similarities and the differences between those two approaches as fans?
The biggest difference, and this is an obvious one, is that baseball is 162 games, right? You can't, if you were to melt down at the same level that Raptors and Leafs fans do sometimes after every game, you would die, probably. Like, you can't do that 162 times. You shouldn't do it 82 times, but you could survive because usually you have the next day off. Like, you don't have to do it every single day. You know, if you're a Jays fan and you're going to have to melt down 11 times in the next 10 days because of the schedule and the doubleheader and everything and all those Rays games. Yeah, I mean, you might, but get yourself an off day in there. At least take the Texas series off then. So it does inform a little bit more, not patience, but, you know, I think there's at least an appropriate understanding that it's a long season and you're going to have some ups and downs. Some of the, like, oh, they're so streaky conversation irritated me a little bit, just because, like, I kept pulling the numbers and updating the numbers. I'm like, they're not any streakier than anyone else. Like, right. But then you score 2 runs over an Angels series. And it's like, how do you tell someone that the offense isn't streakier than anyone else when they score 2 runs over 3 games against a bad team? So there's an element of that. And then I think, you know, one of the most interesting things, and I don't have a great Raptors comparison for this, because the Raptors so often kind of, I guess, fight from underneath, where even when the Raptors have been very good, and at this point, they're one of the most stable and well-respected front offices and well-run organizations in all of sports, I think you still get the like, well, nobody believes in us. And like, you, there's almost an element of like, you're always playing with house money as the Raptors. People care really, really heavily. And there's a lot of up and down with that. But Raptors fans always have the thing to lean on of like, well, we're the other. Like, we're fighting for coverage in Toronto. We're fighting for coverage in the U.S. Versus other NBA teams. And I think that that allows you a little bit of, I don't know, like the expectations aren't the same because outside of your own Raptor circle, the expectations are always a little lower than they should be. Like, they beat their win total over under 10 of the last 11 years, and it looks really low to me right now for this year. So you could be looking at 11 of 12. Whereas the Jays, one of the biggest stories of the season for that team and for the fan base, I think, is, well, how does the weight of expectations affect things? Last year was really fun, and it was kind of the innocent climb, to use a Pat Riley term. And this year, half the people at Fangraphs are picking you to make the World Series. And that's not a Toronto thing. That's a national baseball media thing. And you haven't delivered in that same way. So that's been, I don't have a good way to like wrap that up and tie that together, but that has been the most interesting part for me of going from the prove 'em chip on your shoulder franchise to a team that has legitimate high-end expectations, not just in the city, but outside of it, and how that affects things. Because how that affects things is you've won 15 of your last 21. You've won 11 of your last 13 on the road. You're in a playoff spot with like almost a 5-game cushion here in the last couple weeks. And it feels like this team has dramatically underperformed still, even though they're 76-60. So that's been, it's been pretty fascinating for me to go through.
Blake, before we let you go, we had a mailbag earlier in the show. One of the questions I thought would be best answered by you and Zoobs, and for me to just step gracefully aside. That's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to redo this question. It is a wrestling question from Catcher in the Rye at On Catcher. Can you give all the Jays, now, to be fair, we don't have to do the entire roster here. Can you give all the Jays wrestling bios and preferred finishing moves, please? So I'm going to let you guys take care of that in whatever way seems best to you and go.
I think it makes sense to each pick one, whether it be a single unit or a tag team. I think the obvious one is Alek Manoah, but I will let you sort of.
No, I think Alek Manoah is such an obvious one that neither of us should be allowed to pick him.
Yeah.
He's 6'6", 285. He's from Florida. He loves mixed martial arts. Like, I would bet good money that guy watches Attitude Era highlights on Instagram. Like, when in between bump day posts, he's looking at old like Stone Cold stuff and The Rock stuff and Goldberg stuff. Like, I think that Alek Manoah is so obvious a pick that neither of us should pick him.
Yeah, so I have a couple of ways to lean. I feel like a tag team of like good vibes only, that with like Teoscar and Lourdes, was like, it's, they're so similar that it's almost like twin magic, and they slide in and out and it's all good vibes. But I think the interesting one is one of my classic favorite tropes is the big guy, little guy team. I think you put Alejandro Kirk with a healthy Hyunjin Ryu, and you sort of have the like the small dog that does all the yapping, and then the big guy that sort of stands there and doesn't do much. And then when it gets time to get a chop battle, you throw in Ryu, and he starts throwing lefts, throwing rights, throwing all kinds of different things. So I think Alejandro Kirk is an underrated. He's from Mexico. Small guy, low center of gravity, hard to pick up. You get some bowling ball energy. I think you get Al Kirk as your guy, top rope, senton, where he just falls as hard as he possibly can, is your thing. Because the playing on those oxymorons, you get a small guy, low center of gravity, small heavy, you get him flying around as like a cannonball. I think that would be my pick.
Yeah, I think that's a great one. I think there's a lot you can do from naming that team perspective too. With I don't have it offhand, but there's got to be a way to mix the cuisines of Korea and Mexico into something there. Obviously we know about Hyunjin Ryu's meals on Instagram. Like, it's the biggest thing Alek Manoah provided us last year, was just how much these guys eat. So I like that one. Kirk, as in addition to the senton, you could do the Kevin Owens cannonball in the corner. I think that would be a good Alejandro Kirk move. Hyunjin Ryu is obviously a Vader bomb kind of guy. I like that one. It's so can we go with guys on the 40, or do they have to be on the active roster?
I think if you have a good reason for the 40, I think there's no reason to deny it.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is basically a lesser version of the Manoah one, but Nate Pearson is a huge dude with, sure, like, I kind of associate fastball velocity with like how intense you are. And I know that that's not necessarily fair in the case of, like, we just said Manoah is the most obvious one. He's not the hardest thrower, but Nate Pearson, I don't know, man. That guy would throw a wicked, like, Stan Hansen level lariat, I bet. I could just see him being like a hoss who can work a little, like your Lance Archers of the world, kind of like a big dude who also has some speed and athleticism to him. But when it comes down to it, is just gonna, you know, the big moves are gonna be the strong style stuff.
And it's important to have a built in weakness when it's easy. Oh, you have the biggest, yes, guy and he can't be beat. Any person had, there is a weakness. If you can, like, the gas tank may not be that deep. You can drag, yeah, him into the deep water.
On top of which, like, the I don't know what they call it, but like in a wrestling game when you're doing your ratings or whatever, and it's like your fatigue recovery is like, yes, yeah, like when you're, you know, when the body parts go like green, yellow, and then red, he just, like, his shoulder and his oblique and stuff just get red really quickly. He's gonna get hurt if you don't finish this match immediately. You got to squash matches only, basically.
We could go on. There's the like the second generation tag team. You do obviously Bo and Vlad's
legacy,
absolutely, yeah, right.
So this is like, by the way, to play the legacy thing out, would we be in agreement that Vlad is Randy Orton, Bo Bichette is Cody Rhodes, and Kevin Biggio is Ted DiBiase Jr.?
I think that's absolutely perfect. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. Do they have any more of those guys in the system? We could have someone come up and be like, I forget who it was, but like when they called up like Jimmy Superfly Snuka's son or something like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The Gurriel, technically, I think his dad played in one of the Dominican leagues. And I,
yeah,
it was like Dwight Smith Jr. was a second guy, and they had a Clemens
Jackie
in there.
Bradley is a junior. I don't Jackie know. Bradley. We could extend, yeah, it all out.
We could go on. We could go on.
I also, this is not necessarily he would be a wrestler, but I kind of get wrestling fan vibes from Matt Chapman.
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, he has he's like, oh, this guy's just like a quiet, straightless guy. You hear him talk, and you're like, there's something there. There's something there.
Also, like the I never wear sleeves until I'm contractually mandated to put my jersey on. That's a big wrestler, like wrestling fan thing.
We digress. This could be the whole show if we don't move on. Blake, thank you so much for the time. I know you're a busy guy. I know it's an off day, and you have given us a half an hour of your time to talk Blue Jays. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Jays Talk Plus every single damn day on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and get it where you get podcasts as well. Blake, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Blake. Some great insights there. And before we let you go, we're going to have some insights for you. It is, of course, we are brought to you by North Star Bet. So we're going to look at some lines coming up, some futures that interest us on the run line. Nick, we have talked about quite a few interesting pieces of betting futures on this show. We started off, of course, with the Cy Young. A couple weeks ago, we did the NL MVP and Rookie of the Year conversation. Now it is September. We have just about a month, a little less than a month to go. Not all of these races are sewn up. There are some division race lines that I think interest both of us. Nick, I'll let you start. Which of these divisions has your sort of interest peaked here as we get to the middle of September?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most open division in baseball. It's also, some would say, the worst division in baseball. The AL Central, being led right now by the Cleveland Guardians with a little bit of a lead over the Minnesota Twins. And then the Chicago White Sox are lurking in the background there. The Guardians are at minus 152, Twins plus 230, White Sox plus 450 as of recording. And, you know, it's an interesting one. You know, that's a lot of juice for the Guardians for a relatively low lead. Like, I'm not sure that that's a bet that I'm dying to put down, but Minnesota has dealt with so many injury problems. I'm not a believer that they can come all the way back here. They're not at their best, to be honest. I think Minnesota is arguably a more talented team, particularly their position player core. But right now, it's hard to see them mounting a late surge. The team that's lurking is the Chicago White Sox, and they have been incredibly disappointing all year long. You know, I think their fans have been in an uproar about Tony La Russa, the way the team's been handled. And yet, when I look at this roster, which is actually relatively healthy right now, I think that they're probably the best team in terms of raw talent in the division. At plus 450, it's interesting. It's a nice little long shot there because there's so much juice on the Guardians. The Twins don't do anything for me. Maybe I'm stupid to still believe that there's something there with the White Sox, but the position player core is still good. The rotation is very strong. Dylan Cease is an absolute monster. You know, they've got Liam Hendricks leading a bullpen that has some good talent there too. They could turn things around at any time. And I don't know if they will. I don't know if I'd say you can definitely believe in the White Sox, but at this point in the season, they're the type of long shot that might be worth a sprinkle.
Yeah, really interesting to look at this and like Cleveland leading the division, depending on where you look, playoff odds below 50%. Like it's a real log jam. The lead is two games, as you said, coming into it. I think there is some interesting things to root for down the stretch here. I have a little bit more of a long shot, as always. I love a big number. I love some juice, and I love something that you can put your heart behind. It's a matter of how much do you really believe in this Yankee slide. They have, of course, as of time of recording, won 4 straight games, but they are only 5 games up after being up, I think it was 15 games earlier in the season. They are 5 games up on the Rays. They still have to play the Rays again. You can get the Rays to win the AL East at plus 950. The Yankees minus 1600, of course, to hang on. It's a long shot. I am telling you that it's a long shot, but if anybody can make something that doesn't make sense, it is the Tampa Bay Rays. That is why they are put on this earth, to spoil the fun for teams that think everything is going great and think they have the paper advantage. Of course, it's going to be tough talking about a big lead dropped late in the season, but if you really believe in this Yankees collapse, if you really think they aren't that good, or if you just good old-fashioned want to cheer for the Yankees to embarrass themselves down the stretch, there's value here. Also, you can do the Blue Jays are plus 1500. It's a little bit further. I mean, listen, it's only a game and a half, but you have to have the Jays passing the Rays as well as the Yankees. The Jays do play the Rays again coming down the stretch here, the 4 games in 3 days coming up. So there's a chance there. But if you wanted to lay some skin on the Yankees collapse being a real deal, you can get the Rays at plus 950 to win the American League East. Is it a bridge too far for you, Nick? Probably, right?
It is, but it would be fun. I mean, I think you point out the entertainment side of that bet is fantastic. The idea that you get to cheer on the Yankees potentially going from historic win season to falling out of a division lead over a very short period of time. That is, as you say, delicious. When you think about it, though, you know, a 5-game lead in a month of the season, that's like as if the Rays would be a 30-game pace better than the Yankees over the next stretch. That is a little bit hard for me to believe. Like, they'd really probably have to sweep the Yankees in their series. That's when this bet could get incredibly interesting. I would lay off of it, but at the same time, like, there is an entertainment component to betting. There is putting your heart on the line and just getting potentially rewarded for seeing your dreams come true. That is sometimes the magic of it. So in that regard, there's definitely something to it.
That is my whole ethos, and mixed results at best, let's say. You can find lines on all kinds of things, all kinds of great futures, as well as action every single day on NorthStarBets.ca. You also get Nick's incredible work. You get insights, some deep dives, some stats, some analysis on matchups of all kinds. Check that out, NorthStarBets.ca. And speaking of NorthStarBets, they are the sponsor of this show. We thank them so much for being a part of the Pitch Talks community and bringing this show to you from us. I am your boy, Andrew Zuber, from The Parlay, here to say goodbye. Nick, anything else to add before we say goodbye to the folks here? Another episode of Pitch Talks.
I think you said it absolutely perfectly. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for, you know, subscribing, rating, all those algorithm-related things that are people tell me important. And we will see you in a couple weeks here.
Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.